Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to the Victor Davis Hanson Show. This is our Friday news roundup, and we've got lots of stories from the week. The ship that hit the Baltimore Francis Scott Key Bridge, and we also have... what are the other things on the agenda? Sean Diddy Combs, and then the Trump decision, bond decision, was reduced by a significant amount. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back, Victor. It's a very busy week, and especially probably one of the greatest accidents that we've seen in a very long time. It was almost like watching those World Trade Towers fall. You kept wanting to see it again. How did that happen? But I was wondering your thoughts on the ship crashing into the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
Well, there's so many conspiracy theories. There's suggestions that the ship had bad fuel, so it cut out. I don't know why other ships haven't cut out, if that was endemic in the harbor, so I'm not sure that's right. There was suggestions that the entire crew was Indian and was not well acquainted with the harbor. I don't think there's much currency to that. People are giving a lot of credit to law enforcement that got a 4-minute warning that the ship's engines had cut out and then closed the bridge, so that there was actually no car, apparently, that went off the bridge. They were able to stop traffic coming over. The problem was that was the third largest span in the world, I think. And when you looked at it, it looked sort of like the Dumbarton Bridge or the San Mateo Bridge, in the sense that they had concrete pillars spaced that were very sturdy, but for entry in and out of the exit, they had to have one long space where the bridge went higher to give more clearance, and it was wider so two ships could pass through, and that required a span. And unfortunately, the ship hit that pillar, and then there was reports that the pillar didn't have what they called dolphins, or protective concrete slabs that jut out from it, sort of, that disrupted. I don't think anything could have stopped a ship of that magnitude. It was so big, and those containers were so high. So we don't really know what happened. I did an interview with Eric Bolin on Newsmax, and he pointed out with illustrations, if you go to the Maersk, M-A-E-R-S-K, that's the Danish holding company from the Møller family that runs it. It's the largest shipping company in the world. All of their web advertisements to go to work are all DEI. They're all about gay people or non-white people. And we are a protective environment. We have over 100,000 employees. Our main mission is to make is inclusivity. And that raises the question in the context of the Boeing problem, the United program, problem that the program we've talked about of pilot training and crew training at United that guarantees 50% graduates are DEI. Are we using non-meritocratic criteria to put positions up for, you know, employment that are not going to be merit based? In other words, they're just going to be sinecures for people of particular ideologies or race or ethnicities or sexual orientation, but they're not going to be competitively vied for. In the case of DEI, these are going to be acts of omission, that we're spending labor and capital auditing us on things that have nothing to do with clean fuel or competent pilots or knowledge of harbors. And so we don't know to what degree that problem is what we've seen at United and Boeing and the rails in East Palestine. We've had, I think, double the number of near misses in airlines the last 10 years. So those are all the questions that have been raised. And I don't think they're going to build this very quickly. One thing we do know from the California Bay Bridge, that our ancestors who built them in, I think, 2 years, the Bay Bridge, and maybe 2.5, the Golden Gate, or 1.5, they knew how to build bridges, and they knew how to do it quickly, and they were more competent. And their attitude is, this is what we can do, and our attitude is, this is what we can't do. And so I doubt this huge span will be built for years. One thing I don't understand is, why don't they just do what they do in New York and have tunnels? Why didn't they just tunnel under it, like the BART tube in the Bay Area? You'd never have a problem then for a highway.
Yeah, even the French and the English could get together on that.
I think they just
took
the cheap way out in the 70s.
Yeah.
It looked pretty fragile, too. It didn't even shudder. It just, when they hit that one pillar, the whole thing took the whole thing down.
Yeah, I have a curiosity. They kept talking about the anchors should have been dropped, but the electricity went out. So I thought,
that's based on the generators from the fuel. And the fuel was bad, or the engines cut out, and the engines cut out, the electricity cut out.
Does that affect the anchors, though? They should
yes,
have,
it
could
does,
they have
but
dropped
the,
it?
I think, and I'm not an expert on it, but I think all of the anchors can be deployed manually.
So they could just cut something open and the thing drops out of the
bottom? I think they can do it with a winch, but it would take longer. But I don't think the dragging anchors when it was going 6 or 7 knots, I don't think it's going to slow it down for a mile.
Yeah.
Not something that big. Yeah. So big. And so it's just part of this, I don't know what it is, this sense that our generation, I'm speaking as a baby boomer, 70, is incompetent. And we can't go to the moon. We can't build high-speed rail. Our universities we destroyed that we inherited. We don't build things anymore very well. Look at the World Trade Center. It took almost, 16 years to finish? And I doubt this bridge will, if it is finished, it'll take 10 or 12 years.
Yeah. Well, since you're talking about the DEI issues, apparently the CEO of Boeing has stepped down, David Calhoun, and the chairman of the Boeing Board of Directors, Larry Kellner, is planning on not reapplying or rerunning to be the chairman next year.
And they all should be fired. I mean, they took the blue chip label in the industry. It had a better name than Airbus. And what did they do? They destroyed their label.
Yeah.
We'd have to know why. I mean, when you have a door fall off from the manufacturer to Alaskan Airlines, it wasn't even bolted on. Then you had a panel fall off. And then you have an airplane, I guess it was a 777, where you have a switch where a crew member just walks into the captain's thing, and I guess her leg hits the switch. It makes the the chair go forward, and he hits the controls, and the next thing, 50 people are injured, and they just have these radical variations in altitude. So something's wrong, and we'll see what their emphases were, whether they were like Anheuser-Busch or Target or Disney, and they just started DEI, DEI, DEI.
Yeah.
At some point, people are going to say, you know, go back in history and look at DEI. Whenever you use ideology or tribe or gender, whatever it is, instead of merit, you have problems. Whether it's Mao and the revolution of 66 to 76, when ideology adjudicated whether you're going to be an engineer or not. And it just destroyed the whole society.
Yeah.
Or King Cotton in the South, all the money spent on these pseudo ideas about race and phrenology. And it was just a complete apartheid system that didn't create productivity. And it created King Cotton, and that was it. And the same thing with Jim Crow and its aftermath. And then you look at, I mentioned this in an article. That's the only reason I'm referencing. You ask yourself, why did Napoleon run wild for 18 years, given France's population? Territory wasn't nearly as impressive as the combined resources of Prussia and Britain, for example, not to mention Russia. And that was because the old Bourbon marshals of France that he inherited, he completely rebooted. And then he started to get people in there who were not just aristocratic, but they weren't Jacobins either. They were promoted and honored for their performance on the battlefield. And that really helped France. They had a meritocratic army. And the way that Russia got rid of the commissar system by October 1942, when they led to these catastrophic encirclements outside of Kiev and Moscow, where they lost, over 1.5 million. They lost 5 million that first year. By October, they'd lost 8 million of 42. And they said, no more ideology. Let Zhukov or Konev do what they need to do. But anytime you start to inject politics or ideology, race, gender, as the barometer of promotion or hiring or competency, then your society unwinds.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, who are going to replace these two at Boeing? So I looked at the board, presumptive chair of the board, probably in April, I think they're going to have these elections. And his former company is just, everything is, they have a whole long page of DEI. And I just wonder when these companies are going to start saying, basically, we hope everybody has a good life and we like whatever your differences are. That's great. But we target and preference skill and merit and excellence in our company. They got to change that.
Well, you'll see the universities. Look what they're doing. The Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford brand. Stanford, as I said, led in 21% white. That was based not on the applicant's preparation, test scores, which are optional, GPA, but what? Their skin color. And 9% of the incoming class are males, and they compose about 35% of the population. So you're really taking that one demographic and you're saying there's only going to be 200 of you each year at Stanford. And we're going to take athletes, we're going to take dean's kids, provost kids, and legacies out of that. And there's only about 5 or 6 people probably who are white males at Stanford who really earned that on merit.
Yeah.
And then that's the beginning, not the end. Then you tell the faculty, well, we used to have these standards that we insisted upon. We were most selective in the country on merit, and that's why we had the toughest curriculum. We turned out the best educated. But now we found out that was all a sham. There was no need for it. It was anti-meritocratic because real meritocracy is defined by race, ethnic heritage, gender, sexual orientation. So what we want you faculty to do is make sure that when we give you this new class, that you bring in new classes, you lessen the workload, and you inflate the grades. And we'll still claim that they're Stanford graduates, and nobody will know the difference. That's not going to work.
Yeah.
Same thing with the military. You know, how can the military be the same when it's I have noticed one thing, though. When you look at commercials today, have you noticed the last, 3 months? They're all about people jumping out of planes and parachuting and flying jets and piloting helicopters. Kind of the old be what all you can be commercial. And they're not women, you know, pregnant women and flight suits or gay couples in cartoons. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, okay, that didn't work, but we're not going to say it didn't work. But this one demographic that we're short 45,000 and we know who didn't sign up, we want you to sign up again.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're going to do it.
I don't think they're going to. That's almost assuming that they're so stupid they can't see through what the military's up to.
The military is saying we're going to appeal to, but we're not going to change DEI.
Yeah.
They're going to have to get rid of DEI.
Yeah. Well, I thought since we're on it, that an interesting Gallup poll came out with a 30-point difference between women and men in their political views between the ages of 18 and 30. The political difference is women tend to be liberal by 30 points and men conservative. And they said, it was interesting in this article I was reading, I won't mention the publication, but it was left wing, and it said, well, this might be for several reasons, that men are, one, consistent and have just stayed conservative. Two, that they're more conservative and anti-feminist. So the anti-feminists had to go with the more conservative. And then the last one was, maybe it's just Trump.
I would beg to differ. Yeah. I think there's two reasons and two reasons only. One, when you look at women, either in junior college or four-year programs, they now consist of about 55 or 60% of the student body. So they're more likely to be indoctrinated at universities. And then the issue of abortion.
Yeah.
They feel that's really all they care about. And they think the Democratic Party is abortion on demand, and the Republican Party is not, and they're right about that. So I think that really changes a lot.
All right.
That and the fact that the fertility rate is 1.7. So a lot of young women are being told in the university, as AOC reminded us, that the world is boiling and you just can't put a kid in a hot pot and boil him. And that's what would be his future. So you can't have children. If you don't have children, then, you know, you're not so worried about the schools. You're not so worried about the police. You can just navigate and worry about yourself. But if you worry about your kids and educating them and keeping them safe and health care, then you tend to be a little bit more conservative.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Victor, let's go ahead and take a break and then come back and talk a little bit about Sean Diddy Combs and the Trump bond decision. Stay with us and we'll be back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back. You can find Victor at his website, victorhanson.com. It's called The Blade of Perseus, and there's lots of content on there that's free, but also the VDH Ultra material that appears three times a week. And you can subscribe to read at $5 a month or $50 a year, and we welcome one and all to it. Victor, the sponsor of this show is Alliance Defending Freedom. Our God-given freedoms are facing unrelenting attacks. It is a battle for truth, and the only way we win is if we stand together. Thankfully, Alliance Defending Freedom has been defending our rights for 30 years and winning. Now, they're involved in two critical cases before the Supreme Court. They're suing the FDA for endangering the health and safety of women and girls. And in the second case, they're assisting the state of Idaho to defend its law protecting the lives of women and their unborn children against the Biden administration's attempt to override the law and force doctors to perform abortions. and they need your help. With your best gift, you courageously join ADF in fighting critical Supreme Court cases against government lawlessness and help defend our cherished freedoms. Go to joinadf.org/Victor. That's joinadf.org/Victor to give now. And with your help and pledge, we hope to raise $5,000 by March 31st for ADF. Visit joinadf.org/Victor to make your best gift right now. I know with your help, we can beat that goal and help make a generational difference for freedom. And we thank ADF for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Well, Victor, I don't know if you have much to say, but apparently Sean Diddy Combs's home was raided, and the raid was done because of a sex trafficking case. So it sounds kind of grim, but what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know quite how we define sex trafficking, if it's something like, out of the movies where you... have that movie Taken. Remember Taken? And yeah. There's all these Middle East people that are getting young virgins or supposedly kidnapping
selling them. Yeah.
I think more what it means now is that celebrities like Epstein or Diddy with all this money kind of do what Hugh Hefner used to do, and that is have just young people come in and live there, and they're expected to take drugs and party and have sex anonymously with people who come over. So if you're Hugh Hefner or you're Diddy, you say, it's a party at my place, my estate. And you come over and there's all these women he's paid, and they're sort of prostitutes. Yeah. And some of them, maybe they're unwillingly, and they came willingly at first, but maybe they're under financial coercion or whatever.
Yeah.
But again, it's like Epstein. We're never going to know who went there. There was a very disturbing photo shot of little Justin Bieber when he was 15.
Yeah.
And Diddy has his arm around him and says, we can't tell all the great things that are going to happen to you here. And then he says, when are you going to get me a girl?
No, he says, what are we going to do now? And he goes, we're going to go get girls.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was self-incriminatory. And I think Diddy thought that he was a DEI powerful black man who's, I think he's worth $900 million. He was untouchable because he was flagrant about it. I think the biggest rapper is JC. He's worth $2.5 billion. Then it's Diddy at $900 million. And then I think Kanye West. Yee, is that his name?
Yee.
Yeah. Well, Yee now has gone from, I think, $1.5 billion down to $400 million.
Oh, no.
And then people like, Ice Cube, and they're in the 100 millions,
yeah.
200 million. But I don't know what he was doing. I think he's just having a party. I think a lot of people allowed this to go on for years. And so when we say sex trafficking, you could probably go after Hugh Hefner. You could have for the same thing.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what exactly it's supposed to mean in this case. Well, the Donald Trump bond decision was made, of course, on Monday, and they dropped the requirement of the bond to $175 million. I was listening to Democratic commentators, and they were complaining that Trump is getting his own way and it's his own rules. Yeah, that's why the cases are there in the first place. But anyways, what were your thoughts? Yeah,
they're just entirely unhinged. I mean, he has all that property, and it was stupid to have a $455 accruing interest bond to pay the $355 million. He's still got to pay the $355 million unless he wins the suit. But there was no jury, and there was this judge that hated his guts, and there was this prosecutor who tweeted and high-fived the settlement, and she shouldn't have done that. She was still on social media bragging about the interest accruing every day. And it was a joke. There was no crime, no victim. Banks are happy. Everybody understands if you overvalue real estate and you're getting a loan, the bank's auditors catch you and they adjudicate and adjust. You can't say, my little farm out here is worth $10 million, but if I tried to do it, I wouldn't get a loan because the auditors would come in and take a look at it. So they knew what Mar-a-Lago was worth. It wasn't worth $17 million. And after that time, it was probably worth $500 million. And they knew that. So they were happy to loan him the money. And it's just Letita James ran on this. She fundraised it on it. And it was get Trump. And, you know, I was looking at MSNBC and the people were laughing that there was any coordination with the White House. But we know Fannie Willis's paramour, Nathan Wade, went to the White House and was counseled. And we know that Merrick Garland was, through third parties, told that Joe Biden was angry at him because he hadn't indicted anybody, and he's shortly appointed Jack Smith. So I think a lot of this was coordinated out of the White House. That was true. Which brings up, you know, this a peripheral story is this Rona McDaniel. McDaniel.
Rona.
So she wanted to be a MSNBC political commentator. And I guess she did because, well, why did she want to do it? She either wanted to get the $300,000, or not mutually exclusive, she wanted to get more exposure, get on TV, B, or she looked at Rhino, Bulwark, Dispatch transitioning Republicans that they use to track. Like Michael Steele, you remember him?
Yeah.
The black guy who was, he failed. I mean, he ran for senator. He failed. I think he was lieutenant governor from Maryland. But after Obama won, they wanted to have an African-American RNC, and he was a total disaster. He lasted about 2 or 3 years. And then when Trump came along, he saw his opportunity, went to MSNBC, and completely flipped into a left-wing zealot. And then, you know, so that was pretty much, I think, what she thought she was going to do. Go the Nicole Wallace, who was the communications director for George W. Bush, supposedly Sarah Palin's handler, but probably her anti-handler. And she became the same way. She flipped.
Yeah.
And Joe Scarborough was a Republican congressman. Then he flipped. So I think she thought, well, I'm just going to transition in here and be your token Republican and not say anything offensive. And then as the years go on, I'll just melt into the ideological wallpaper, so to speak, and I'll be just like they are. But they didn't allow that to happen. It was so funny. They're so paranoid. They're so scared about what's going to happen in November. I mean, Rachel Maddow said, we don't tell the untruth there. I said, Rachel, I think, Rachel, that's all you do. You beat the collusion and the laptop disinformation to death. You wouldn't let anybody say that the virus originated in the lab. It was the pangolin bat lie. And then they had Chris Matthews there. He's a total politico. It was just so crazy that they say, we don't do this, we don't have politics, we don't lie. The biggest thing about them was they had the most notorious liar in Washington, John Brennan. He was the former CIA director. So they're looking around for a Trump hater who will propagandize on MSNBC. They say, let's get John Brennan. He's the CIA director. And they say, well, why would we get him? Well, he lied. He lies. He's a good liar. Remember, he went under Senate. He went into the Senate and he took an oath and he said he swore to uphold the truth and nothing but the truth. And they ask him, did you ever spy on our staffer computer? No, no, no way. We don't do that. Lie. And he caught it. They caught him and he had, I'm so sorry. I lied to you. Next time he came in, what about those predators, the Obama, remember how he loved to kill people with the predator assassination spree along the border in Afghanistan? Yes. Well, how many collateral damage, how many people were killed? We hear there were 75 people. No, no, not one person was killed. Not one person? No. Oh, under oath? Sure. Yes. And then he comes back. Oh, I'm so sorry. I lied about that as well. You caught me twice. And so then they're thinking, well, we're on MSNBC, and we got to get guys that are alive for the left. So we hired John Brennan. And true to form, we brought him in, and we thought, oh, my God, there is a debate coming up and an election in 10 days. The debate's coming up in 3. And what are we going to do? Trump's going to kill Biden about that laptop. There's the big guy, there's Mr. 10%, there's the drugs. Hey, at least you don't have to pay for Pop's utilities like I do. There it is. And so Anthony Blinken steps up and says, well, I'll get 51 authorities. And they will swear that it's Russian disinformation. That kind of cheat a little bit. It has all the hallmarks. It all looks like it. Benchmarks. And so they call Mike Morrell, and he calls John Brennan. So John Brennan and the other liar, James Clapper, who was an analyst for CNN, and he was the one that lied. Remember, said, does the NSA ever spy? No. You liar, we caught you under oath. Well, I told the least untruthful narrative. Okay, that's okay. We're not going to prosecute you. It's not like you're Donald Trump or somebody. So they brought in John Brennan, and then he lied again and signed this letter. And then so he's got a trifecta of lying. And then Rachel Maddow says, and Jory Reid says, and on MSNBC, we can't get people who lie. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. You're Jory Reid. You were the one that tweeted that this Governor Chris, what's his name? He was the Florida governor. You kept saying honey, and he was a girl, and right. You tweeted, and you were so homophobic, Joy. And then what did you do?
Lie.
Oh, I was hacked. The FBI will be looking at this. Yeah, they looked at it and they said, you're a damn liar. You were not hacked. So then what happened? Did she get fired for lying twice? No. She's still there. And she has a whole corpus of homophobic tweets. And she lied that she wrote them. And she lied and said they were hacked. And the FBI basically said, you're a liar. And MSNBC said, you're a liar. But you're a black woman in the age of woke and DEI. And now you can go back on TV and say, you will not tolerate Rona McDaniel because she's lied. And then they got Jen Psaki on there. Remember her?
She was a bad liar, though.
It was Jen Psaki. Jen, circle back. I'll circle back. And I remember her two famous lies. They said when she left, there's been 4 million people who crossed that border. Do you know that? You know what she said? Well, it doesn't really matter. They're only here temporarily. It's not like they're going to stay.
Yeah, sure.
That was really funny when she totally lied about that. And then, of course, the biggest whopper of all was
Rachel Maddow.
No, it was Jen Psaki when they said remember Joe Biden wanted to brag that he got all of the people out of Afghanistan on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. 2021. So no matter what the generals told him, he was going to get out. And they said, don't get out too quick. Keep Bagram. We've got a plan for 3,500 soldiers to get the biggest air base to control the airspace near Pakistan, Russia, China. Don't do it. And he said, nope, we're getting out. And they said, if you get out, it's going to be a bloodbath. And what did Jen Psaki say when she was asked? Did the generals ever warn Joe Biden of the consequences of this? No, he had no idea. They never told him. You liar. So they're all liars, and now they don't like to bring in a Republican megaphone. And, I mean, it's just a joke.
Yeah, I know. And that's why when you first come on this subject, I thought you were going to say Rachel Maddow, because she was the biggest megaphone for all those lies about Donald Trump.
She did four big lies. She did the Russian collusion lie. She said the laptop disinformation lie. Yep. She even did the Alpha Ping bank communication with Russia, Putin's poodle lie.
Yep.
And she did the pangolin bat. You have no business suggesting it came from the lab lie. COVID.
Isn't part of her dossier that she's a Rhodes Scholar or something?
Yeah, she is. And that makes it even worse.
I know. It shows you.
It shows you with a quality of Rhodes Scholars.
And what education people, can do to you.
They were so weird. I really like their little sanctimonious. We're a community here of journalists. And we don't want in our ranks people who are rank liars. I'm thinking, no, you go out and seek rank liars. You do. That's what you do. And that's why John Brennan was your analyst on foreign affairs. And that's why he we don't get people who participate in politics. Yeah, he was your MSNBC analyst while he was going around everybody's back, sneaking around getting these 51 people to write a bogus letter that lies that the laptop is Russian disinformation so that Joe Biden, 3 days later, can say, listen, Trump, I resent you calling me a crook just because of that lap. 51, Donald, 51 intelligence authorities have said that this is Russian disinformation. And I was watching that, the debate, and I wrote something about it. And at that time, everybody was so self-righteous. Oh, you see how they proved it was Russian disinformation? And I'm thinking, yeah. So there's a bunch of little Ruskies in the Kremlin, and somebody says, have you ever seen Hunter naked? Let's Photoshop his naked body. What's he like? We'll make him take selfies. What do you think we should call Joe Biden? How about big guy? How about Mr. 10%? We can put that in. Can we put all of this? Hey, I got an idea. We'll have Hunter, and he'll communicate with his sister or his cousin, and we'll say when he asks for women, she'll say, no Asians, no Asians. And Hunter says, yeah, no Asians. We'll put all of that stuff in. It's brilliant. And we were supposed to believe that.
Yeah, I know that the Russians were so brilliant. Of course, they like that. Since we're
like,
on this.
Like the PP tape that they admitted now was a complete bogus thing.
Since we're on this issue of lying, and here I'm turning to sort of general blindness of the left, I got caught up in some articles written in left-wing publications, and this one was, why we can't stop arguing about whether Trump is a fascist. And I was curious, like, what would the left say about it? So the article went through and said, well, he hasn't done anything yet, but we're going to talk about what he might do. But they did have a concise what to look out for. So finally, the author towards the end said, to know when we ought to panic, it's helpful to know what to look out for. So that he said this, don't think of armband insignias, tanks in the streets, and martial law. Think instead warfare, sophisticated cronyism, surveillance, all the things they do, and counter-majoritarian restrictions on reproductive rights, voting access, and academic freedom.
In other words, he's a conservative. Exactly. I know what fascism is, what they think he's going to be a fascist. He might call to pack the Supreme Court.
Might.
No, that's what they did. He'll get rid of the Electoral College. No, that's what he'll do. He'll demand two more states. No, that's what they did. I know what he'll do. As soon as the Senate's in the hands of the majority, he'll ask for the, tell them to abolish the No, that's what they did. Huh. I have a better idea. Maybe Trump will be so smart, he'll get the FBI to work with X to censor the news. No, that's what they did. Oh, I know what he'll do. He'll get an FBI lawyer to doctor a document to get a FISA warrant to spy on. No, that's what they did. I know what he'd do. He'll hire somebody to make up a file that Hunter and Joe were in China and they urinated on a bed that Trump slept in. No, that's what they did. let's see. Maybe he will weaponize the CIA to go after his enemy. No, that's what he did. I know what he'll do. He'll get the IRS to stop any investigation of Eric or Don Jr. No, that's what Biden did. So it's all projection, 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 projection.
Sure.
We have 4 years. And the thing about Trump was he suffered on both ends because he talked this wild, I'm going to get these SOBs. And so they said, look how mean he is. And they didn't do it. He let that anonymous run wild, whoever that guy, that creepy guy, Chad somebody in the Homeland Security, the New York Times said, a major figure in the Trump. No, he was some little kid that had a dead-end job who was saying, we're so enlightened and we're so we're stopping at every juncture that Trump executive orders because we're morally superior.
Oh, my God. How dull.
I know. They were all dull and boring.
And blind. All right. Let's take a break and come back, and we'll talk a little bit about a skier before Congress. Stay with us.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back. Be sure to catch Victor on his X platform at VD Hansen and then on Facebook at Hansen's Morning Cup. Victor, so did you see this? Speaking of another kind of slightly funny and not sympathetic thing, this Gus Schumacher who testified about climate change and his expertise was his skill at skiing.
Yes, I did. And what's his name? Had him for lunch, Senator...
John Kennedy. Yes, he did.
Yeah, he just... And that was... Do you remember in the 80s? They always do that, the left. In the 80s when all the farms were going under. I wrote about it in Fields Without Dreams called The Great Raisin Crash. We woke up one day and the price of raisins went from $1,400 a ton to $440. But they made a movie, The River. You remember that with Mel Gibson and Sissy Spacek? And they made another one. Anyway, when they were talking about farm foreclosures, they brought in movie stars because they were in a movie that played farm depression.
Yeah.
And they always do that. They want young, good-looking people to come in and then testify about something they know nothing about, and they have an IQ of about 10. And then we're supposed to be really impressed because the left is so... celebrity fixated. They love Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so they bring in Hollywood people to testify, and then usually the Republicans just let them go, but Senator Kennedy's kind of...
Didn't let this guy go.
He's a good Red Rhodes Scholar, yeah, and it was so cruel. He just said to him, and you have expertise on global warming, and you know the temperature declines, and you know how much it's going to cost to eliminate fossil fuels. And he goes, no, I just don't do. And you're here for what reason? And your expertise is, well, you know, I kind of snow and it's kind of melting.
I liked how he showed that you're stupid on this subject and you also tweeted abolishing the police.
And he said, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm thinking, well, why don't you go to the next room and testify about abolishing the police.
And that the war on drugs was created for incarcerating blacks. And
yes, I think he meant when abolish the police that they were going to abolish the ski patrol when he was skiing. We can get by without a ski patrol. All of us wealthy, privileged white people. We won't have a ski patrol. That's our part.
He was kind of impressive in his...
He had kind of self-mocking idea. He did.
Yeah.
They tore him to pieces and he was shredded and he was kind of laughing about what an idiot he was.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why the hell did they bring me here? I don't know F-U-C-K. I don't know nothing.
All right. Let's turn then to our most favorite topic today, which is the president of Mexico, Obrador. And he has recently given a speech that the flow of illegal immigrants to the U.S. will continue unless they send billions in aid to Latin America. I think his number was 20 billion. They remove sanctions on Venezuela, end embargo on Cuba, and grant millions already in the United States work visas. I was wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, he was on 60 Minutes. And Mr. Obrador, remember how Trump had slapped him around a little bit because he started the same thing with Trump? He said, no, we're just going to redo NAFTA. And then we want you to do this. And he cooperated. But he said he wants $20 billion in bribes, basically. And that goes to Latin America. In his view, all of these failed states that are corrupt, they could be perfect if we gave them $20 billion. And number two, remember that he said he wants amnesty for Mexican citizens, in Mexicans, not others, just here. So remember he said when Biden went down, isn't it beautiful that we've sent 40 million of our citizens? I mean, can you imagine an American president say 40 million Americans left? That's wonderful. Why doesn't he say we need that those people here? But he didn't. He was bragging that he drove them out. It was the weirdest thing. Isn't it great that we're so corrupt, the cartels are so violent, and we stole all the money from our rich remittances and oil revenues that I drove 40 million of my own people out?
Yeah.
And then he wants, as you said, he wants us to lift all embargoes against Venezuela, who, as I last remember, Venezuela has a death squad. Maduro's people have killed hundreds of people, candidates. He's like Putin. He's a thug. He's sending criminals up here, as we saw with Lake and Riley, who was killed by a Venezuelan. And you know what? Guyana, he's already told everybody, that little tiny country to the east of him that's got all the oil, we're going to go invade it. And so we're supposed to lift embargoes. And then, of course, he loves Cuba. So we're supposed to say, well, you know, Castro is in retirement. It's not that bad a place. We're just going to let him, and that's not going to happen. So then what did he say if we didn't do it? Quote, the flow of migrants will continue. I guess that means another 2 or 3 million illegals will come this last year. He also said that his country was not corrupt. I think it's number 11 in the world in corruption out of 180. And then he said it wasn't violent. It's in the top 10 of murders per capita in the world. And then he said there was no drug use in Mexico. It was our fault. And the cartels were just reacting to demand. If that were true, they would just be making little pills that say fentanyl and send it here. But they're doing it as Ativan, Seconal, any drug that they can mask, because they know their product will kill people. But you can just buy these other drugs and it will make you, you know, high because it's got fentanyl in it. So basically they are importing every illicit drug on the market without having to produce them. They just lace every one of these tablets, fake it look like a prescription drug. Valium, Ativan, I don't know, lorazepam, you name it. Just stamp it, put the little number on, get the right color, and put fentanyl on. That's what they're doing. They're killing 100,000 people. He doesn't care.
That
he
said sounds he had a, dangerous.
It is. Like, that's what
it
they
could
do.
Get into a regular pharmacy as those.
I don't know about that. But
I hope not.
If you're an 18-year-old and somebody's at a party and said, hey, man, I got these little blue Valiums. They're great. You take one, you're kind of mellow. Come on, man. You take it and you die.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening. And, you know, nobody does anything to him. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it, with friends like Obrador, why do you need an enemy like Putin or Xi or anybody or Kim Jong-un? He's killed more people than China or Russia. You know, he always brags, I have my little Volkswagen, I'm driving around, I wave to people. Nobody, the cartels love me. They love you because you turned over a quarter of the country to them.
Yeah.
And there's 180,000 of them that are running. They run your government.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is, why is he doing this now? Why all of a sudden? It's an election year, right? So he calls up 60 Minutes, and I've got to get in. And he thinks, you know, number one, I don't want them to cut. We've got 10 million people now that came under Biden. And the melting pot is dead. They run by tribalism up there, and I've got expatriate advocates, and I want this to continue. And they give me $60 billion in remittances. And that money is subsidized by the American taxpayer because my citizens go up there. They break the law when they enter. They break the law when they reside. They break the law with phony ID. They get their welfare check, and then that frees up their cash. And so they send me $300 a week. And I get $60 billion, largest source of revenue. And then I think he thinks Biden deliberately destroyed this border to get my citizens to come. And therefore, I will rub his nose in it because he wants Mexican nationals to go in the United States illegally because when they count the census, they'll get more, they think, Democratic districts, and they may vote in the next election since they'll go to the DMV, the disability office, the welfare office, and they will get a mail-in ballot automatically, and no one dares to check whether they are a citizen, because if they do, they say, you're racist, you believe in voter suppression. And so they want me. They may say they want don't want to close the border, but they want. And you know what? They say they're decoupling from China, and they want, he said that in the interview. Well, they need our cars. We're building stuff. We're not China. We're your new China. So he really thinks that that he has
leverage.
Yeah, and he looks at Biden. I think everybody should understand how that man Obrador's mind works. And it works something like, he's like every passive-aggressive bully. He respects the strong enemy that he slanders, and he has utter contempt for the weak leader he praises. So he said, Biden's a nice guy, but I hate the guy's guts because he's weak. I hate Trump, but I respect him because I never know what he's going to do to me, and I got to be careful. And the question is, what do you do with this guy? Because Mexico, if it wasn't Mexico, by every classical definition, it's an enemy. What if all these people are saying on to Moscow were to say that Vladimir Putin right now is shipping in fentanyl and killing 100,000 Americans? Or that every day every year we get 3 million Russians coming in. They would go nuts. So what do you do with him?
What do you do? I mean,
I know what you do with him.
They're going to give him money, I think.
You can't do anything. Yeah, they're going to welcome, they're going to give him money. They're going to open the borders. They feel, as I said before, Mayorkas and Biden are talking probably every day something to the effect that this was the greatest success of this administration. They may say years from now we destroyed the border, but we know what they're really going to mean. We got 10 million illegal aliens. Can you believe that? And that helped us for years to come. So they're proud of it. But if they elect Trump, you could stop it in 2 seconds. You just finish the wall, the real wall, not the fake wall, not the old wall, the real wall. Finish it. And then Trump said he was going to deport people. You start deporting the first, 200,000. Say, look, 10 million of you are here. If you are here and if you are illegally here, we're going to find you because you're going to have a check or you're going to come in to a welfare and we're going to deport you. We're going to be very nice about it and humane, but you're going to have to go back. And we're going to tell Obrador, we're not going to fly them to Venezuela. We're not going to fly them to Honduras. We're not going to fly them to Nigeria. We're not going to fly them to Dubai. We're just going to put them back where they came from, and that's your country. So you deal with them. You fly them out. You spend the money. And we could do that, and then we should just say, you know what? I don't know why Trump didn't do this. People talked about it. Steve Miller talked about it. All we have to do is say for anybody, anytime, anywhere in the United States that sends any money back to Mexico, it's a 10% tax. So $60 billion that's wired back there, or we'll do it on the internet, or we'll do it on, you're going to pay. We could just go to PayPal or Venmo or the banks or Western Union, or you name it, and just say, no money is going into Mexico unless it has a 10% tax on it. We're going to get $6 billion, and finally Trump can say that Mexico paid for the wall. Yeah. These are going to be U.S. residents who are Mexican citizens who are on U.S. welfare support, and they are using our money for their housing, their legal needs, their educational supplements, their food, you name it, and that frees them up with cash. And that's they're sending that back to Mexico, and he knows it. So if you put a 10%, he would go crazy. Next thing you have to do, you just say the cartels are terrorist organizations. They are.
They are.
Just say they're a foreign terrorist organization. What would that mean? That means any bank in Mexico that facilitates one terrorist account is we're going to sanction it. That means it can have no business with any American affiliation. You could shut down their entire financial structure. And then you should put U.S. troops on the border. Just put, I don't know, put a division. 16,000 people along the border, have them rotate in and out, and their job would be to deter mass crossings of cartels, to give firepower, to beef up the border patrol. But more importantly, it would tell the Chinese authorities, law enforcement or army are going into U.S. Some of them are going into U.S. territory all the time. And we'll see how they like that. And then after, do that for about a year and then have Mr. Obrador go back on 60 Minutes and say, well, how's it going? And he's going to say, oh, I love the remittance tax. I like the idea that U.S. troops are on the border. I like the new wall. I think it's good that you sanction the court. I don't think so. And then he'll be a little different.
Let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope.
All right. Well, last story of the week is the UN Security Council passed a resolution to support ceasefire in Gaza for the Israelis. And that's, per their usual stance, which is generally speaking anti-Israel. But I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal by Bernard Henry Levy, and he was arguing that anything but what people who really want to stop things in Gaza should do is put pressure on Hamas to surrender, because any sort of ceasefire is merely going to embolden a terrorist organization and the Arab street, basically. And I thought that was he had a pretty convincing argument, but I was wondering what your thoughts were on this UN Security Council.
Well, didn't we abstain? The first time we abstained.
Yeah.
And I think John Kirby said, well, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it did matter. You put more daylight between us and our staunchest ally. And almost everything that we hear now about Gaza is not true. I was just thinking that the other day. Remember the word occupied Gaza? That Gaza's occupied? No, it isn't. There hasn't been a Jewish or Israeli citizen there since what, 2005? You had your election. You elected Hamas. They threw the Palestinian Authority rivals out windows and killed them. Then they said to you, screw you, we're never going to have another election. And then they took billions of dollars in food and aid and cash, and they built a 500-mile subterranean labyrinth. That's what they did. But remember, they had a three-state solution. There was Gaza, and there was a Palestinian Authority, and there was Israel. So don't tell us that they were occupied by the Israelis. They weren't. And then they always talk about collateral damage. Collateral is damage. It's too much damage. There is no word in the Gazan vocabulary for collateral. If you go over to Gaza or to the radical Palestinians and say, how many Jews were collateral damage? What would they say? Well, there's no collateral damage. We kill them all. We don't care whether we did it by accident or by intent. That's the purpose. We kill Jews.
Yeah.
And so we sent 7,000 rockets into civilian centers. Were they military installations? No. You sent 7,000 rockets in? Yes. What was the point? To kill Jews. So there was no collateral. I don't even know what that means. They're just Jews. We kill them. And that is just so silly. And so think of the logic. They put all these poor women and children and elderly people inside hospitals, schools, and mosques where Hamas is either there or is dug down beneath them. So they're human shields. And I guess their logic is Israel has more reservations about collaterally hitting our civilians than we do exposing them as shields. And that explains one weird thing about this war. Why doesn't Israel have human shields around their cities? So when the rockets come in, why don't they do that?
Because they're humane.
Yes, and if they put Israelis on the top of every high-rise, civilians, and they had signs, this is a hospital, then Gaza would particularly pick that out for a choice target.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they could kill it. Then there was the disproportionate. Israel is disproportionate. What was Gaza trying to do on October 7th? Did they say, okay, we've killed 500 innocent women and children. We better stop so they can be proportionately responded to. No. They're only talking about disproportionality because it's not their purview now. It's the Israelis. As long as they were disproportionate and it killed 12,000 to 200, they were happy with it. So were the people in the street. So were the people on campus. And the thing that still applies to the ceasefire, we have to have a ceasefire. We could have a ceasefire tomorrow. All you have to say is surrender the 20 people who planned it and give back the hostages. And they can't do that because the 20 people who planned it are somewhere in Dubai or Beirut living it up. And I think they've killed the hostages. I really do. I hate to say it. They do not want to talk about the hostages. But we had a ceasefire. Mr. Kirby, in next press conference, when you discuss a ceasefire, just say, why did Hamas break the ceasefire? It was called the October 6th ceasefire. There was no fighting until on October 7th. They broke the peace. They broke the ceasefire. And you never mentioned that. Another funny thing about it is, did you hear Biden say that he's calling for the Israelis to quiet down during Ramadan? I don't know if there's only one group of people who believe that Arabs and Muslims should not fight during Ramadan. You know who it is? Westerners, Americans in particular. In October 6th of 1973, Egypt and Syria surprise attacked Israel for two reasons. One, it was the Jewish holiday, right, of Yom Kippur, and it was during Ramadan. So when you go there to the Middle East, anytime I've ever talked to the Middle East resident and they've mentioned 73, how do they reference it? They reference it as the Ramadan War. They're proud of the Ramadan War.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they picked October 7th because it was it Shemshat Torah or Shemini Torah on Shabbat? It was a holiday. So why in the world would we call for a ceasefire during Ramadan when the people that you're trying to help have the ceasefire deliberately picked a Jewish holiday where people would be at a concert and they could butcher them just like they did 50 years ago when they deliberately picked a Jewish holiday and it was their holiday coincided as well and they didn't care at all? It's... You know, the civilian deaths are tragic, but I happened to walk through the rubble of Fallujah, and I can tell you, there was no, I mean, that was the most incredible thing. It looked like Dresden. And when we flattened Mosul, it looked like Tokyo circa, 1945. And the thing about it is, if more civilians die than your soldiers, Israel considers that a big failure. But if more Gazans die than Hamas terrorists, they feel that is globally advantageous. The more civilians that die, they think they can have it. You know what else is going to be weird? I'm going through weirdness. I'm going to write a column about that. I just wrote some weirdness things down. We're going to end up giving them more aid after October 7th than we did before. Now that we're building this multi-million dollar pier and we're going to pour all this stuff in, it's going to be like the Kabul airport too. Wait, it'll be somebody who'll blow it up. But we're going to give them more war, and they're going to look at that as guilt money or shame money or reward money. Or
don't go with the Chinese money.
Yes, I guess. Somebody should ask themselves on campus, next time I walk, if I walk by the Stanford, they took it down, the Gaza camp, but all these people confront you, wherever they see. If that reappears, I'm going to ask them, would you rather be a prisoner of the IDF or Hamas? I'd say that to a young woman. Are you more likely to be sexually assaulted by Hamas in custody? Well, forget about, in war. Of course they do. But they blood libeled the IDF and said, now the UN said they had no rapes. But we just have all of these prisoners that come forward, how they were sexually molested and tortured and abused under Hamas. So everybody knows that, and yet no one ever says that. Just say to all these campus people, would you rather, if you were caught there and you were taken by Hamas, and you said, but I support Hamas, I'm a little Harvard undergraduate, and I protested. Are you going to be treated better there or with going to the IDF and saying, hey, you guys, I hate you, I protested against you, now I'm your prisoner? What do you think happens? I bet the IDF said, you SOB, we don't like you, here's some more warm food. If you go to say that to Hamas, they'll say, blank you.
Yeah.
And so
that's the state of things.
The whole thing is just a joke. It really is.
Yeah.
People cannot make a simple moral distinction from one side who goes into the country next to it during a time of religious holiday and peace and brings 3,000 people in to slit throats, cut off heads, mass rape, burn babies alive, torture people, drag people back on motorcycles and cars, loot, steal, rampage, burn, and then try to take hostages so they won't be held accountable. And the other side who says, okay, that's what you did. We're going to go back over to your side and we're going to find all the people who did it and we're going to destroy Hamas. But we're not going to try to rape, kill, dismember, mutilate, behead the way you did. Now, we may kill a lot of people, but we want everybody to get out because we know they're hiding among you in hospitals, schools, and mosques. They can't make that distinction.
No. Well, Victor, we're at the end of our show today, and I have a listener that enjoyed your discussion of Jim Plunkett's. I enjoyed Victor's recounting of Jim Plunkett's football career. Two amazing facts to add. Jim's parents were legally blind, and as a consequence, his family financial situation was always tenuous. Originally drafted by parentally inept Boston Patriots, Plunkett was seen as the savior of this luckless franchise. Jim's team was extremely weak, and the coaching staff and management were even worse. He literally ran for his life during his five seasons with the Pats. Somehow, despite the tough hand he was dealt, Plunkett preserved and won two Super Bowls and Super Bowl MVPs, proving good guys can finish first. He should be the NFL Hall of Fame. He should be in.
He should. I knew his parents were blind, and he was part Native American. He was built like an oak. He was just so big and strong. And I was at the USC game his junior year when he almost beat USC on the last play, I think it was. They had a long pass. And he was beloved at Stanford. And then he got drafted. He was just beat up. They had no front line at the Patriots. And then he came to San Francisco, and he had a so-so career as a backup. And then he went to Al Davis, and he was given a good line and a good team. And he went to the Super Bowl twice. And he was a great comeback quarterback. He was the tense and more stress there was when you were behind and you had to pass and they knew you had to pass. He was more accurate. And he was one of the kindest people you'd ever see when they interviewed. He was very modest. He wasn't like today's athlete at all. He was self-effacing. He was, when I was a student at Stanford, I went to a bank at Stanford Shopping Center. He was ahead of me with his wife. And he just seemed that same way in person. So he was a great, great quarterback. He was a wonderful athlete. I didn't even realize he wasn't in the Hall. He should be tomorrow.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful person and a wonderful athlete.
Yeah.
And a guy grew up, that was the nicest thing I thought about Stanford. They had, wow, they have Jim Plunkett. What a wonderful place. And that was on the old Stanford Stadium before the boxes and everything, when they had the track and everything. It was the original stadium.
Well, that was by NBP Teagle. And then I just have a really short one, and it's an inquiry. It says philosophical schools, and maybe this is something we can do in the future, but he says, Please go on about the Stoics and Skeptics.
Yes, I haven't done that. We did the Aristotelians, the Peripatetics, and we did the Platonics, Platonist, and we'll have to do Zeno.
Yeah.
And the Garden of Epicurus.
Maybe in a couple of weeks. This weekend we're doing the historians.
I had an undergraduate teacher. It was a wonderful teacher, John P. Lynch. And he wrote as his thesis, Aristotle's School, where he tried to locate the school. It's really was in Syntagma Square. The academy was out by the bus station. And he had an envisioned plan to do Aristotle's School, Plato's Academy, Zeno, Stoa, and the Epicurean's Garden, the four philosophical schools. And he only did the first one. And he wrote a lot of other stuff. He got sidetracked, but he spent most of his time with undergraduates teaching them. He was a wonderful teacher, but they have a book. They have a couple books on Plato's Academy about the school, how it functioned and where it was in Athens, etc. So the Epicureans got sort of a bad name, you know, sensualists. But if you're really interested, you can always read Lucretius, De Natura Deorum, on the nature, De Natura Rerum, on the nature of things. And he talks about Epicurean, don't fear death, and you're just going to be discombobulated, your atoms. It's from Democritus, the atomic theory. And then Zeno, we have a lot of... We know a lot about Zeno via Seneca, the Roman moral philosophers, and the effect that had on Roman statesmen that were Stoics. Yeah. And then we have Marcus Aurelius, who wrote his Meditations in Greek, and they're kind of a pop version of Stoicism.
All right. Well, tomorrow we will have the historians, I think we were going to look at, Livy and...
But we'll come back to that. That's a good point. We'll do the Stoics and the Epicureans.
Yeah, later. All right. Well, thanks to our audience for being with us. And thank you, Victor.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
This is Sammy Wink and Victor Davis Hanson, and we are signing off.